Today is Wednesday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, shock and outrage as 18-year-old gunman kills 19 children and two adults at a Texas elementary school.
Beautiful, innocent, second, third, fourth graders. And how many scores of little children who witness what happened, see their friends die as if they're on a battlefield, for God's sake.
China and Russian bombers fly over Asian waters as U.S. President Joe Biden meet other leaders in Japan.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says the Chinese-Russian joint military patrol with strategic bombers was likely planned well in advance of the U.S. president's trip to Asia.
And Pakistan bans planned rally by the opposition following the killing of a policeman. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Flags across the United States have been ordered to fly at half-staff by President Joe Biden following the shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, that left 19 young students and two adults dead. More on the president's reaction to the killings from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
President Joe Biden, in a seven-minute-long address to the nation Tuesday evening, said mass shootings like the one earlier in the day in a Texas farming community do not happen with the same frequency in other countries as they do in America.
Why? Why are we willing to live with this carnage? Why do we keep letting this happen? Where in God's name is our backbone?
The president added it is time to turn this pain into action, calling for politicians to stand up to the gun lobby and pass what he called common sense laws to make assault weapons harder to acquire. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Russia and China on Tuesday flew bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons over the Sea of Japan and East China Sea while U.S. President Joe Biden was in Tokyo. This was the first joint military exercise by the two countries since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Here again is VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says the Chinese-Russian joint military patrol with strategic bombers was likely planned well in advance of the U.S. president's trip to Asia.
Beijing's decision to cooperate with Moscow in this way, amid Russia's further invasion of Ukraine and the Kremlin's dangerous nuclear rhetoric, demonstrates the quote-unquote no-limits partnerships that they talked about in their joint communique.
In Tokyo, the government says it believes the aerial drill was timed to make it more provocative than in the past, while the leaders of Japan, the United States, Australia, and India were meeting in the Japanese capital. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
President Joe Biden has warned fellow leaders of the informal Indo-Pacific Security Coalition known as the Quad that they are, in his words, navigating through a dark hour in our shared history, unquote. His warning comes as Russia continues a brutal war on Ukraine. Biden used the war to send a message to China to uphold the fundamental principles of the international order. In a joint statement, the Quad leaders, quote, reiterated our strong resolve to maintain the peace and stability in the region, unquote. Flashpoint's Ukraine Steve Miller discusses the impact of the rule of the Quad, a group originally formed to address China's influence, with Jeff Smith, a research fellow in Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center.
In some ways mirrors what's been happening at a bilateral level between India and the U.S., which is statements of condemnation of Russia's actions in Ukraine, strong statements by the U.S., sort of more vague and generalized statements from the Indian side, in effect condemning Russia's actions in Ukraine without specifically naming Russia. So condemning the use of force and an attempt to change borders. And India's position has effectively been, we want this war to end, but we're not going to go out on a limb and criticize Russia directly. And that phenomenon has been playing out at the bilateral level. And I think we saw that to a degree also at Quad level and in the Quad joint statement. Prime Minister Modi, I think in his own remarks, carefully avoided condemning Russia, but they have, in the sort of subtle language of diplomacy, been moving toward stronger condemnations of Russia's actions in Ukraine. That's what happened at the Quad.
If we take a look at the members of the Quad, Australia, India, Japan, Japan, and of course the United States. There are other countries in South Asia and Southeast Asia that are not part of it. And there's, of course, the ASEAN countries that have their own association. So do you see the Quad being extra vessel to expand upon bilateral negotiations and discussions?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, you know, the Quad rests atop this network of very strong bilateral and trilateral connections that had already existed. I mean, obviously, the United States has formal treaty alliances with Australia and Japan. Those two also do a lot of strong cooperation with each other. That's existed for decades. And the U.S.-India relationship has grown tremendously over the past 20 years. And so the Quad is in some ways like the top layer of icing on this cake, on this network of existing relationships. And I think it's helpful in showing that on a lot of issues, and particularly those issues in the Indo-Pacific, these four democracies are aligned. They have similar visions for a free and open Indo-Pacific and what type of rules should undergird that order. And they have similar threat assessments on who is acting belligerently and who is undermining the international order. They also, I think, are four countries with the will and capability to push back against China when it's acting belligerently.
That's Flashpoint's Ukraine Steve Miller speaking with Jeff Smith, a research fellow in Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. The European Union accused Russia Tuesday of using food as a weapon to blackmail poorer countries as the grouping looks for ways to export, by land and possibly by sea, millions of tons of stored Ukrainian grain trapped by a Russian port blockade. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen accused Moscow of weaponizing food security, as she says it has with energy exports.
In Russian-occupied Ukraine, the Kremlin's army is confiscating grain stocks and machinery. Today, Russia's artillery is bombarding grain warehouses in Ukraine, deliberately. And Russian warships in the Black Sea are blockading Ukrainian ships full of wheat and sunflower seeds.
The European Union says the bloc is largely food self-sufficient, although the Ukraine war has bumped up food and fertilizer prices. The poorest countries and their people are feeling the biggest hit. Ukraine and Russia count among the world's top exporters of grains and cooking oil.
Bread prices in Lebanon have increased by 70%, and food shipments from Odessa could not reach Somalia.
Moscow blames the food crisis on Western sanctions against it. With Russia blockading Ukraine's ports that once exported 90% of Kyiv's goods, European agricultural ministers were meeting Tuesday to discuss land options. Solutions need to be found fast, before Ukraine's next harvest, or there will be no place to store it. Here's Finnish agricultural minister Antti Kurvinen on the EU's so-called solidarity lanes, intended to export Ukrainian harvests largely by rail and road.
I see the solidarity lanes very important because I'm really worried about the global food security. Maybe we in Europe can manage, but Not every people in developing countries.
Jörg Sackmann, a senior fellow for Brussels Economic Research Group, Bruegel, says there are several export alternatives to Ukrainian ports, including shipping from neighboring Romania.
The next option is to bring the grain via either truck or via train to the essentially Polish border.
But he says there are logistical and regulatory challenges.
There's a couple of different elements one can do to ease the bottlenecks, but whether it all adds up to a massive amount of grain exports is another question.
Ukrainian officials say land routes can only export a fraction of the goods. Meanwhile, EU member state Lithuania has proposed a non-military naval coalition to protect Ukrainian grain exports by sea as a humanitarian mission. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
100 million people around the world has been displaced this year. That's twice the number of people displaced a decade ago, according to the Norwegian Refugee Council. Jan Egeland is Secretary General of the International Humanitarian Organization. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the reason the world has, in his words, crossed this horrific milestone is attributed to the war in Ukraine, which he says has cost 40 million internally displaced persons and refugees.
20 million refugees and internally displaced at the end of last year got an additional 14 million Ukrainians, and here we are, more than 100 million driven out by conflict and war today.
How has the war in Ukraine impacted people already displaced around the world, particularly those in Africa?
What we did in the Norwegian Refugee Council through our internal displacement monitoring center was to map at the end of last year where the worst displacement crisis were. And it surprised me that no other place on earth before Ukraine had so many people been displaced as in Ethiopia. More than 5 million displacements, meaning movements, times a child, a woman or a man had been driven out from their homes, either by conflict or in this case also by natural disasters. The Africa has of late been the continent of enforced displacement by violence and conflict. Now, of course, we're back to Europe having that terrible record.
You mentioned Ethiopia. You're talking about Tigray in particular, Tigray area?
In Ethiopia, Tigray was and is the place where the biggest humanitarian crisis is. But in addition to Tigray, there are also other parts of the country where there has been violence, ethnic and other violence. So it is Ethiopia had both violence displacement and natural disaster displacement, like so many other places on Earth. But the 100 million are only violence displaced. The natural disaster displacements, which are tens of millions more, driven by climate change, comes on top.
What about the areas of South Sudan and Sudan? There have been a lot of refugees in neighboring countries, as you know, for many, many years. Has that situation gotten any worse or better in the last year or two?
No, it got worse last year, and it's continuing to disintegrate. Darfur was a crisis which I led the international response on and for 15 years ago when I was the Undersecretary General of Humanitarian Affairs in the United Nations. And it's heartbreaking to see that the Darfur crisis is now unraveling again. I thought we had solved that one. We have not. In South Sudan, there is a neglected emergency, more violence, but also more natural disasters. It's a lethal cocktail, really, of reasons for why the vulnerable have to flee their homes.
That's Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking from Oslo, Norway, to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Pakistan's government on Tuesday banned a planned protest march by ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan, who is demanding fresh elections as a political and economic crisis deepens in the nuclear-armed nation. The ban was announced by Interior Minister Rana Sanula at a news briefing hours after a policeman was shot and killed during a crackdown on Khan supporters across the country. Police said authorities in Islamabad have started putting up blockades at roads leading to important installations, and heavy contingents from police and paramilitary troops have also been deployed. Khan had urged his supporters to march to Islamabad on Wednesday. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaur.
Literally, Pakistan is under siege, because sitting in Islamabad here in the capital, I can tell you that no one can leave the capital or enter the capital. This is the kind of restrictions or blockage they have erected around the capital. Like, all the streets leading into the city have been blocked with shipping containers, and even the highways that are coming from other cities toward Islamabad have been blocked to make sure that no crowd comes really close to the capital city. So already we see this sort of paralysis or a sort of crippling situation here where no traffic is moving.
The government is alleging that the reason for banning the rally is because a supporter of former Prime Minister Imran Khan killed a policeman. What has been the reaction from that party? And officially, is this rally still on?
Yeah, the rally is on, very much on. In fact, just half an hour ago, Imran Khan made a fresh announcement that he is going to come to Islamabad with a huge crowd come what may. And as far as this policeman's death, I mean, that's a debatable question. Both sides are accusing each other for this one death that has occurred. It's because it's like middle of the night, some policeman jumped over the wall and entered the house of a former soldier. And according to that soldier, who is now has been put behind the bar, has said that he thought that in the middle of the night, there was some kind of thief, somebody tried to break into his house, so he had to, in self-defense, retaliate with whatever weapon he had. And we are going to see some big gathering outside the Capitol tomorrow. So life has been paralyzed by the government's restrictions that, like, blocking the road and that they have created prevent people from entering or leaving Islamabad. It's not only created serious problems for the residents of Islamabad, but the rest of the country is also facing the effect of these restrictions that the government has put in place.
If former Prime Minister Imran Khan defies the government ban, can he be arrested? Does he still have immunity?
No, he does not have any immunity, and the government has already warned Imran Khan that if his protest turns violent, he will be arrested. But before the protest, there is no chance or no way that the government will arrest him. This restriction that the government has put in place will very much be, I think, gone on Wednesday morning as a result of this petition that the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear, because that's the primary plea that the petitioner has taken in this case, that fundamental rights of Pakistanis are being undermined and a democratic right of protest is being undermined.
That's VOA Sayaz Goh speaking with me from Islamabad. In other news, South Korea says North Korea has fired two ballistic missiles towards the sea. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the missiles were fired towards waters off North Korea's eastern coast. The officials gave no further details about the launches. They were North Korea's 17th round of missiles firings this year. Experts say North Korea's testing is aimed at modernizing its weapons arsenal and at applying pressure on its rivals amid long-dormant nuclear diplomacy. North Korea's unusual pace in weapons tests this year included its first test of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017 in March. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Turkey is vowing to crush the presence of the Kurdish militant group PKK in Iraq. The PKK has used neighboring Iraq as its main base in its war for greater minority rights in Turkey. But as the Turkish military closes in on the PKK, analysts warn that the Turkish group could turn to Iran with implications across the region, including U.S. forces in Syria. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul.
Turkish forces, backed by jets and drones, are driving the PKK Kurdish militant group from its bases across Iraqi Kurdistan. For decades, the mountainous region has provided the PKK a sanctuary to launch attacks in its battle for greater minority rights across the border in Turkey. With President Recep Tayyip Erdogan claiming to have the support of local Iraqi Kurdish forces, the PKK's once deemed impregnable headquarters in the Kandil Mountains is now the target of Turkish forces. Aydın Selcan is the former head of Turkey's consulate in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Because the politicians, they have to speak with symbols, they have to say something. When you say Kandil is our ultimate target or aim, whatever, it means that so the ultimate step is to stop PKK from existing altogether.
The PKK bases are in the Kandil Mountains bordering Iran, a rival of Turkey. As the Turkish military steps up its offensive, some analysts suggest the PKK could turn to Iran for support. Despite having its own restive Kurdish minority, Tehran has in the past found common ground with the PKK, whose influence extends to Iraqi and Syrian Kurds. Hussein Baja is president of the Foreign Policy Institute, a research organization in Ankara.
Iran supported PKK in the 80s and 90s very strongly. And now, when the Russians are out of the scene, not so strong, then probably Iran will take their place. And PKK and PYD, of course, they will try to use PKK as a leverage in their relations with Turkey.
Observers point out Iranian-backed Iraqi militias like the PMU already have contact with groups linked to the PKK. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Joe Biden used the war in Ukraine to send a message to China. Biden ended his six-day trip to Asia that included a Tokyo summit with the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia. For more on this topic and others, join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the arrests by Hong Kong authorities of 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen, the former Catholic Bishop of Hong Kong and outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, and three other prominent pro-democracy advocates, Margaret Ng, a lawyer and former legislator, Hoi Po Kung, a scholar and former professor, and Denise Ho, an actress and singer. The four were trustees of the now-dissolved 612 Humanitarian Relief Fund, which was established in 2019 to provide financial and legal assistance to those who participated in pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. They were falsely charged and arrested on May 11th for colluding with foreign forces and subsequently released on bail, but could face sentences of life imprisonment. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, in arresting these veteran activists, scholars, and religious leaders under the so-called national security law, Hong Kong authorities have again demonstrated that they will pursue all means necessary to stifle dissent and undercut protected rights and freedoms. Then White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called on PRC and Hong Kong authorities to cease targeting Hong Kong's advocates, noting that freedom of expression is critical to prosperous and secure societies. Over the past several years, Beijing has been increasing its control over Hong Kong, arresting democracy activists, shuttering civil society groups, and forcing independent media organizations to close. The PRC has increasingly violated the fundamental freedoms of the people of Hong Kong that were guaranteed in the Basic Law and in the Sino-British Joint Declaration when control of Hong Kong was transferred from Britain to the People's Republic of China in 1997. The arrests come just days after the only Chinese Communist Party-approved candidate for the Hong Kong chief executive position, former Hong Kong security chief John Lee Kak-chew, took office. After his so-called election, the foreign ministers of the G7 countries, which include Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, published a statement expressing grave concern over the selection process for the chief executive in Hong Kong, as part of a continued assault on political pluralism and fundamental freedoms. We continue to call on China, they declared, to act in accordance with the Sino-British Joint Declaration and its other legal obligations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.